from the studios of KPCW in Park City. It's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. And on today's show, we first speak with Chris Perkins, who is the Vice President of Programs at the nonprofit Outdoor Recreation Roundtable. He comes on to share more about the recently released Trail Map for Rural Development in America, a resource designed to guide federal, state, local, tribal, and philanthropic leaders in harnessing the environmental, economic, and therapeutic power of outdoor recreation.
Yes, then, in the second part of the show, climate justice and clean air advocate Mace Gonzalez of Green Latinos, another nonprofit organization, comes on to talk about the work being done by that group in the areas of environmental education, awareness, and advocacy. All that and a little update on some of the fires going on within Utah.
Very devastating.
And northern Arizona, those big ones there. It is fire season, and we've had no rain here in Summit County for, almost a month. It's been a very, very dry.
A very smattering. We've had, we had July 4th was our last really big rainfall.
And, in some areas. Because I was out in one part where it was rain, where I saw rain falling. But, that's the nature of showers around here.
They can
be. In the
be.
Summer. Very localized.
Yeah, very localized.
So we'll give you an update on the fire situation here in the state of Utah. Environmental awareness and education. That's what This Green Earth is all about.
And welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us now is Chris Perkins, who is the Vice President of Programming at Outdoor Recreation Roundtable. Chris, thank you so much for being a part of This Green Earth.
Hey, very good to be here, and thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to this chat.
So to set the table and begin, why don't you give us a lowdown on who Outdoor Recreation Roundtable is, how they got started, and your part or role that you play there?
Sure. So the Outdoor Recreation Roundtable, or ORR, is a coalition of trade associations, businesses, colleges and universities, and state offices of outdoor recreation. And we collectively represent the entire outdoor recreation economy. And that means it's a pretty diverse group of folks around the same table. It's hikers with bikers, skiers with climbers, hunters, fishers, boaters, RVers, campers, motorized users, horseback riders, hospitality, all working together to expand access to the outdoors and ensure that everyone benefits from time outside. And so what we do is try to raise visibility for that industry, talk about what sorts of investments or initiatives can help communities and people benefit from the outdoors, which makes for a pretty fun job for me. I'm the Vice President of Programs, which means I work with rural communities on their outdoor recreation initiatives. I support state offices of outdoor recreation, like the Utah Division of Outdoor Recreation. I also work on workforce development.
I know that you put together a new map for our rural trails, but I would like to first do the overarching umbrella that talks about this rural development toolkit, why that's important, and who came together to get that up and running so that different communities have a better tool set to get them set up for their recreation activities outdoors.
So everyone knows the story of the first days of the COVID pandemic. All of us were a little concerned, confused, and figuring out how to reorient our lives. And it turns out that when millions and millions of Americans faced that same question, everyone made a similar decision to go outdoors. When you look at participation data for the past few years, especially since COVID, more Americans are getting outdoors than ever before. And not just that, they're actually moving to places that provide great outdoor recreation opportunities because quality of life is increasingly a prime reason that people are moving to places across the country. In fact, when the Utah Office of Economic Opportunity, University of Utah come together, they surveyed tech sector workers who were coming to Utah. They said, why are you coming to Utah to work in the tech industry when you could work anywhere in the country? The number one reason of tech sector workers coming to Utah, 85% of those surveyed was access to the outdoors. Mm. And number two was family. And this is, of course, in Utah, a very family forward state. Similarly, when you interview people who are moving to Maine, outdoor recreation is the number one reason that people move to the state. So in putting together our rural economic development toolkit and rural economic development trail map that we just released, our goal is to help communities tap into this fast-growing sector of the economy and benefit local communities first. When we build new parks and trails and campgrounds and RV parks and marinas, we want that to benefit the local community and their way of life, their public health, their connection to one another. But of course, when you build these places, other people from all around come as well. And so in putting together the toolkit, we've organized 12 best practices sourced from almost 100 interviews nationwide of rural communities developing through outdoor recreation to understand how to do this work well, how to ensure that it benefits local communities first, and how to set places up for a sustainable future through outdoor recreation.
Does ORR do work all around the country, all 50 states?
All 50 states. And in fact, 24 states have created offices of outdoor recreation. I know this is a Utah-based audience, and I think they'll be happy to know that Utah was the first in 2013 to create a state office of outdoor recreation. This was Utah Governor Gary Herbert at the time.
Yes.
He had this vision that Utah and its economy would benefit greatly from a body in state government to manage the growth of the outdoor recreation economy, identify new grants and initiatives, and to get more people outdoors. And all the governors around the country saw what Governor Herbert did and said, I want some of that too. So in 2013, you have Utah creating the first division of outdoor recreation, then Colorado in 2015, Governor Hickenlooper, and now 22 other states for 24 total. And what's neat about this map of offices that we work with is that it really spans the political spectrum. On one hand, you have Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders of Arkansas, or Governor Cox of Utah, or even former Governor Doug Burgum of North Dakota, who's now the Secretary of the Interior. Mm. And on the other, you have Governor Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan, or Governor Josh Shapiro of Pennsylvania, or Governor Wes Moore of Maryland. Mm-hmm. These are all governors who've created official state offices of outdoor recreation. And to me, that represents the bipartisan and unifying appeal of getting outdoors. No matter your political stripes, you can appreciate the value of time outside. And so we're actually, in working with all these offices, doing a campaign this year called 25 in 2025 to create that 25th state office of outdoor recreation, marking half the country who've created these offices to help their communities benefit from the outdoors.
And you had mentioned something at the very end when you were describing all these key components, and one of them was sustainability, which obviously is near and dear to our hearts, because we were just talking actually with a Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance last week, and they were describing impacts that outdoor recreation does have on the environment. So what are ways in which, when you're mapping this out, how does sustainability take a role?
Well, it's first and foremost the most important thing to protect when developing outdoor recreation, because high quality outdoor recreation opportunities rely on high quality outdoor recreation infrastructure and the health of the ecosystems around. So the first thing a community can do is to think strategically before they even dig a foot of trail. Where do we want to congregate users? Where do wildlife use these places? What are places that are too treasured for humans to touch? And in thinking strategically, big picture, before actually building any trails, you can solve a lot of these problems early on. And then the second thing is, once the places are built, you're relying on users to make great decisions when they're out on trails. For instance, in Utah, if it is a particularly rainy period, climbers know not to get on the rocks for 24 or 48 hours to let the resources dry out and recover. So it's those sort of user practices mm-hmm. that are shared amongst different groups, whether that be the bikers or the motorized users or the hikers or climbers, that really help ensure that these resources last for a long time. And the final thing is to actually invest in their long-term health. And that's one of the practices that's identified in our new trail map, is that communities seeking to develop around outdoor recreation need to think beyond just the construction of the infrastructure. They need to be thinking about long-term operations and maintenance, or resilience to extreme weather, or other pressures on the resource, just like any other piece of infrastructure, to ensure that it lasts in the long term, no matter how many users are using it. That's a really big priority for us at ORR. We think an outdoor recreation economy relies on healthy resources first.
Yeah, it is interesting that, you know, the list of those who are engaged with the OOR, like you say, hikers, bikers, hunters, climbers, kayakers, off-road enthusiasts, sometimes their goals and objectives, let's say, could run into each other, or may have different, may go in different directions. So there's a bit of cat herding that goes on, I'm guessing, sometimes.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, there are always things that user groups are going to disagree on, and that's okay. Those debates are important to have, whether it's an appropriate place for a biker to travel versus a horseback rider. Those debates definitely need to happen. But what ORR works on and where we found success is to focus on what we call the 95% of things that all recreationists agree on, which we categorize into three buckets: access, infrastructure, and funding. For too long, when you look at federal and state budgets, when budgets get tight, outdoor recreation is often one of the first things to get put to the side because it's not viewed as a core societal necessity. We think we need to shift that paradigm, and that outdoor recreation, as proven during the COVID pandemic, is actually essential for healthy communities. And so by focusing on access, infrastructure, and funding, as a collective outdoor recreation economy, we've been very successful. For instance, in the last administration, with a highly divided Congress, we passed the Explore Act. And it passed via unanimous consent in both chambers of Congress. This is every Democrat and every Republican in both chambers saying, yes, I want to support outdoor recreation. And it was signed into law toward the end of President Biden's term. That doesn't happen without the entire recreation industry coming together around shared values and saying, you know what? We do have differences here and there, and that's okay. In this case, we want to unite and raise the tide together so that we can all benefit. And that's been really effective for us.
Yeah, I mean, again, you mentioned governors of both political parties who see the value and the benefits that outdoor recreation, the industry per se, brings as far as revenue to the states. You know, it's like you say, from Utah and Arkansas to North Dakota and Michigan and Maryland, et cetera. It's one of the few topics that both parties seemed, it resonates with both parties. I think the, another example is there was some cuts proposed, among other things, to the National Park Service and, say, the U.S. Forest Service. And that got pushback, if I understand, Craig, from both parties, congressmen and senators alike.
National parks have been called America's best idea.
Right.
And I think I agree with that. When you go to these places, you don't just have great experiences in the outdoors, whether that's climbing or hiking or biking or kayaking. You're actually reminded of what it means to be an American citizen, what you have paid into as a taxpayer your entire life, some of the things that give us the biggest pride about being American. When you walk through Zion or Arches or Yosemite or Yellowstone, Great Smoky Mountains, these places that inspire us with awe remind us of how far our country has come. And in my opinion, that's one of the best things we can invest in, whether it's the resources themselves or their staff.
Yes, and we are talking with Chris Perkins, who is the Vice President of Programs at Outdoor Recreation Roundtable. And Chris, when you're talking about partnerships and working together, how does this play in with partnerships with tribal nations?
Yeah, absolutely. So tribes are the original stewards of today's public lands and waters. They know the landscapes, the streams, the currents, the lakes, better than any of us because they've been around for a long time. They're oftentimes the first people to see the positives or experience some of the challenges when places become popular. And so they're definitely first and foremost when putting together a tool like this. How can we develop something that brings tribes in to articulate their vision for their landscapes and to develop a sustainable and authentic outdoor recreation economy? And so there have been cool examples from around the country of tribes. For instance, a tribe down in the Southwest who realized the value of mountain biking to their community and developed an enduro bike race called Resduro. Mm. And this isn't just for tribal members, though they're, of course, showcased heavily in the event. It's a community biking event, but it's really done with tribes and their values in mind. And that's been a great source of economic development for the community. They also have a bike maintenance clinic where they train tribal youth to become workers on bikes and also improve their public health in the process. And it's stories like those that we really want to amplify across the country with the tribal partners that we work with to ensure that outdoor recreation is a value add to those communities.
Yeah, and at the same time, making sure that we understand that there are still thousands, if not tens of thousands, of cultural artifacts that are out there in nature, on their tribes, and elsewhere, all across the state of Utah, for example. And so those of us who like to get outdoors and wander about, whether it's hiking or, you know, in some cases, four-wheeling and stuff, have to be have to honor the fact that we're on, you know, in many ways, we're on native tribes' lands, and their culture is still there, tucked away in different, you know, canyons and riverbeds and streams, et cetera.
Absolutely. It's a huge privilege to be able to recreate on public lands and waters, and it's also a responsibility. Any of us who go outdoors on a given day want to leave that place better than we found it, and that includes cultural resources. And so ensuring that whenever we're on a land unit, whether that's Bureau of Land Management or Forest Service, we're looking at the rules and regulations about places that are open and closed. And in the case that we do find things that are unexpected that might have some cultural value, leaving it where it was found. These places are sacred and are, you know, cornerstones of cultural heritage for multiple millennia. And it's our responsibility to make sure they last as long as possible.
And it looks like you also are looking at some curricula for kids to help them understand what is happening with outdoor recreation, how they recreate, getting kids out there, but also maybe opportunities to work in the field.
Absolutely. I'm a dad myself. I have a 2- and 3-year-olds, and I just got done playing with them on the beach, and so our house is covered in sand, probably will be for the next several months. When I think about the world that they are growing up in, I want them to feel more connected, not less, to the natural world than I did when I was growing up. But yet there are some big headwinds, of course. The rise of technology and social media is capturing kids' attention. You're seeing youth physical and mental health rates in decline. And we see the outdoors as a big opportunity and antidote for those trends, not just to improve physical and mental health, but to connect kids with the people around them, learn how to solve difficult challenges, take healthy risks, and to your point, to enter the workforce. The outdoor recreation economy creates 5 million jobs. And for many kids, this is their entry to the workforce. And it's not just a first job. It's a way to express themselves and find their risks and limits, whether that's being a climbing guide or working in a state park or even working for one of the many outdoor companies in Utah that are making gear and apparel, testing that gear, designing it, and then going out in the field to put it to use. This is a great opportunity, and it really has to start early because kids in the K through 12 age are so impressionable, and the careers they hear about that are reputable are the ones that they're going to dedicate their time and academics to. And we really want the outdoors to be on that list as well.
Yeah, well, obviously here in Park City, easily 95% of us that live here or moved here because of the outdoors. And so no outdoors.
That's right.
No Park City. So we get it. And you can say that for a number of other communities out west or anywhere around the country that resides or depends on outdoor recreation as part of their annual revenues, et cetera.
Park City, Moab, Jackson, Wyoming, Bozeman, Montana, these are places that are known for their outdoor recreation recreation opportunities, and they're fantastic, and I don't want to take that away from them. But some of the communities that get me most excited are the smaller ones that don't have a lot of attention but are doing tons that is community-centric, authentic, and inspired. One of those places is Helper, Utah. This is a rural community historically reliant on mining that is envisioning a bright future through using its natural resources in a different way, through the outdoors. They have the Price River. For many years, it was neglected, waste built up on the side of the river.
Right.
They recognized an opportunity to do something different, working with the Utah Division of Outdoor Recreation over several rounds of grant funding. They've done some ecosystem restoration and beautification of the river. And now you're seeing not just the river use picking up, but also the business development picking up. Now all of a sudden you have a cafe and a brewery, and places are starting to pop out that really improve that quality of life and make a place more livable. I think of Richfield, Utah as well, where they're developing a lot of mountain biking trails and bringing people there from all around the country to live and work. These are the communities that really motivate us, and part of the reason why we're so excited to put out these new rural development tools in the world.
I love your talking about how small communities are rallying and understanding the importance of not only protecting these lands or keeping them healthy and well, but how that does add to the economy and bring people there. But I also want to talk about in a warming world, as the climate is changing and things are becoming a little bit more volatile, what has the map put together or this program put together in the way of maybe a natural disaster, or is there any talk around that?
Absolutely. I mean, you look at some of the most prominent natural disasters in recent years, and outdoor recreation communities are often the most impacted. I think of Hurricane Helene in western North Carolina, in a place that most people thought was a climate haven, and all of a sudden a hurricane rolls through with force that wasn't expected for hundreds or thousands of years. And I had the chance to visit Western North Carolina myself a few months ago and see the damage firsthand. Towns like Old Fort and Chimney Rock and Swannanoa, these places where outdoor recreation is the lifeblood, and they've been knocked off kilter for many months. What stands out to me is there's this incredible resilience in rural America, where when times get tough, people roll up their sleeves and band together and say, how can we solve this? In Western North Carolina, we were able to support that work with some grants provided by the Richard King Mellon Foundation to help rural recreation communities get on their feet. That was in the entire Southeast region. In this roadmap or this trail map for rural development, there's a big emphasis on resilience to natural disasters and doing a lot of that work in advance so that when that flood or wildfire or tornado hits a community, you're not figuring out your systems after the fact. You've actually already determined how you're going to communicate, what's going to be prioritized in advance, so you can enact those systems swiftly and get the recreation infrastructure, which again is really core to many of these communities and their economics. You can get that back online sooner. So it's definitely a big priority, this resource. And our heart goes out to the communities who've gone through through this recently, including in the Hill Country of Texas, knowing just not how much it tears at the fabric, but also how much it impacts these recreation destinations that people have often utilized to feel whole.
Yeah, and real quick, you can now add Grand Canyon Lodge at the North Rim.
That's right.
Of the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, just yesterday. Or over the past week or
yeah,
so.
Yeah, that's right. Just gone.
Mm-hmm.
A place where hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people visited and loved, and a beautiful lodge. Now gone. All the trails around there closed for the rest of the season until further notice, basically. And so, of course, you know, you talk about Helena and flooding in Texas. You know, water, too much water out here. It's too much fire. And so there's another challenge ongoing.
Yeah. ORR's president, Jessica Turner, is on the board of the Grand Canyon Conservatory, and she was going to be headed out there this week for a board meeting. And, of course, because of the devastation, they've canceled. And so now everything has shifted into recovery and resilience mode. And fortunately, there's a lot of great efforts, but just unimaginable seeing what's going on down there.
Right.
Absolutely. I was driving back from Boulder, Utah, and saw, we could see.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or the billowing smoke. So
stunning.
it's something, obviously, and unfortunately, that we need to look toward. And it's things like this and roadmaps like this that help people put systems in place, like you said, so that we are getting ahead of it instead of acting and reacting in the moment.
Educate and advocate.
Absolutely. So this is
That's
a great educational device. So, Chris, where can people go to learn more about this or to get their hands on this map?
So if you search Outdoor Recreation Roundtable Rural Development, you'll find a host of resources that we've put together on rural development through outdoor recreation. There are kind of two key resources that I want to highlight. One is the Outdoor Recreation Roundtable Rural Economic Development Toolkit, which is dedicated to the communities who are leading this work, those local champions, whether they be kayakers or bikers or county commissioners who really see a future through outdoor recreation and need support. That toolkit is for them. When we released it, we had 1,200 people from around the country, from rural communities, sign up to learn about it. So it's been incredibly popular and valuable to rural communities around the country. The newest resource is the Trail Map for Rural Development in America. And the difference here is that this resource is dedicated to all the organizations that are supporting rural communities, whether that be federal and state agencies or philanthropies, foundations, nonprofits, et cetera, and giving them a framework to think about how to support rural communities best so that the economic development that ensures is really community first in mind. And we're happy to publish those two tools. You can find them on the Rural Development page of ORR's website.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Chris Perkins, Vice President of Programs at Outdoor Recreation Roundtable. Thank you for joining us on This Green Earth today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley.
And joining us in the second part of the show is Mace Gonzalez. Mace is the with Green Latinos and the climate justice and clean air advocate with Green Latinos, among other things. And Mace is here to talk all about Green Latinos, objectives and missions and programs, et cetera. Mace, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me here.
Okay, I alluded to, how about if we just start with a little background on Green Latinos, the organization, your mission, objectives, et cetera.
Yeah, definitely. I love giving a little bit of history on Green Latinos. So Green Latinos was originally founded in 2008 as the National Latino Coalition on Climate Change and officially became a nonprofit under Green Latinos in 2012. So we're now 17. We actually just had our quinceañera 2 years ago. It was a lot of fun. We did do a sweet 16, but the quinceañera felt a little more fitting. And it was created out of deep need to center Latino voices in the fight for climate justice. Voices that sometimes have been historically overlooked despite being among some of the most impacted from environmental harms.
Yeah, talk about some of those impacts. How do they express themselves?
Yeah, definitely. So a lot of our work is rooted in kind of the principles of environmental justice and looking at who's being impacted at what types of levels. Because we know environmental issues like air pollution and extreme heat impact all of us. Mm-hmm. But due to past systemic policies or, you know, just things that we've done historically in our country that have made it harder for Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities to, you know, even like buy a home, all compound and relate with environmental issues. So a good example of this is like redlining. Communities of color in the past were only allowed to buy homes in certain areas, and these were usually closer to landfills or factories and highways. And a lot of people think this was like hundreds and hundreds of years ago. Like this, people still live right now that were impacted by this, and in some forms, this still happens. So that kind of highlights how some of these impacts disproportionately affect different communities due to the proximity and how much they're of the pollution they're being exposed to on a daily level. And again, it's a lot of it is due to policies that were done in the past or that are currently being done that don't look at how pollution impacts communities in different levels.
Yeah, when you take a look at your advocacy issues, you break it down by climate justice and clean air, public land, sustainable communities, water equity, and ocean. Can you talk us through some of the projects that you have enacted through Green Latinos that go into each of these buckets, say sustainable communities? What does that look like, and what does your work look like in that area?
Yeah, definitely. Specifically in the Sustainable Communities Program, this program is focused on building a network of Latinx advocates to advance clean transportation, healthy communities, and local civic engagement. So in 2025, we've been working on a new colectivo, which these colectivos are kind of like working groups where we invite different professionals across the environmental sectors or just grassroots individuals who want to get involved to help us support a clean cars and truck campaigns. And this is with like local advocacy as well as federal policy. So we've been doing a lot of work specifically in California and Virginia for this type of work, but we're also trying to continue some of the federal advocacy out in DC, which right now it's a lot of defense work. So as you've probably heard, there's been a lot of rollbacks and a lot of attacks across the board on different public services and incentives, and this doesn't stop in the environmental space. So Sustainable Communities has been looking at which types of like tax incentives for electric vehicles or programs to make electric charging stations are being under attack and how we can kind of combat that.
Yeah, going back to you mentioned the idea of redlining as a historical concept of, in a way, separating communities, white communities from minority communities, honestly. And in Salt Lake Valley, we could probably cite an examples of that between, say, the east and west side of the Salt Lake Valley. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, definitely. So the Salt Lake Valley is a great example of kind of how it's happened. If you zoom out from like in a map, you will see I-15 kind of splitting the valley from right. east and west. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a great visual that helps me kind of understand this, where on the east side and further out from the I-15, we have more green spaces. We have more areas that were deemed like needed, like the East Bench, mm-hmm. and a little bit more of wealth concentrated in that area. Mm-hmm. Where now we have the west side, which historically it's closer to the Great Salt Lake. We have our landfill over there. We have many different polluting sources on the west side, and even like the inland port, which has been in development. And that's really good examples to show you where communities have been pushed. So a lot of Black and Brown communities have historically been on that west side, specifically the northwest. Right. So we're talking west side of Salt Lake City, West Valley City, Magna, even Tooele is kind of considered in this area now that they're being impacted a lot by the Great Salt Lake dust. But that's a good kind of, hopefully, map to kind of place you on where that separation happened. So I-15 is a good marker for that.
Yeah, I mean, lots of large cities have similar stories to tell about with respect to that kind of infrastructure that was put in over the years. And like you say, redlining may not be, it may be a thing of the past, but you're still dealing with kind of the legacy of it and the residue of redlining. It still has an effect.
Yeah, and that's something I think a lot of people don't really like realize is the being only allowed to buy homes in areas that weren't deemed, you know, wanted, mm-hmm. means that you have less property value and you have less wealth to accumulate. So compared to like Salt Lake City, for an example, the east side, where we know some of these homes go for multi-millions, right? Mm-hmm. And compared going up to the other side of the highway, yes, now they're getting a little bit more expensive because I think there's a need to go into these areas, and that's a whole conversation of gentrification.
Right.
But historically, they haven't had the chance to accumulate that wealth. And now they're actually being pushed out of even this area further out to the city. So we're seeing a lot of West Side residents moving further out to like Tooele, to Magna, just because now they can't even afford this area that was once not seen fit.
Right.
I'm curious about your outreach and education and how you are going into communities and talking to them, and are you talking to the younger generation, and what does that look like?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, our biggest focus is to be a convener and to do a lot of this education and just create a space for a lot of the Latino community to feel like they can get involved in environmental issues. Historically, the environmental space doesn't really look very Latino.
No.
While just like mainstream, you know, we have great organizations that are allies to us, like the Sierra Club and Earth Justice. But a lot of the times, the kind of cultural pieces of our community aren't there. So we really do take this approach as a way to build community within our community. So a lot of our outreach looks a little different from other environmental organizations. Like, we do have things called encuentros, which are educational webinars that we bring in experts and they talk about an issue and we make sure that it's bilingual. So we have Spanish interpreters on hand to make sure that this information is being translated in Spanish. And then a lot of our events kind of center on a lot of our cultural roots. So some of these in-person encuentros, like, we'll have mariachi bands, we'll have, you know, like the local paletero, like our a lot of our cultural foods, to make sure that these spaces don't feel like don't feel exclusionary to the Latino community, a little more inviting to our community, since our communities have been impacted by a lot of these environmental issues.
We're speaking with Mese Gonzalez. Mese is the climate justice and clean air advocate for the nonprofit organization Green Latinos. And we're talking all about Green Latinos' missions and goals and objectives and programs that you just mentioned, Mese. What are some of the biggest challenges, again, say in the Salt Lake Valley area, kind of localize the story here? Is it air quality issues? Is it water quality? Is it, say, more asbestos and radon issues in homes or so? I'm sure the answer is all of the above, but is there one that rises above the others?
I'd have to say all of the above for this.
Okay.
We have quite a bit of issues going on, and I feel like they're all compounding, which is something that happens a lot in the environmental space. Nothing is in a silo. So I think maybe a good response is like the cumulative impacts of pollution is something that needs to be kind of seen a lot more in Salt Lake. Like, and we're seeing this with the Great Salt Lake as an amazing example of this.
Right.
Maybe amazing isn't the best word. We love the Great Salt Lake, but we have compounding issues of industrial pollution that is being that around the Great Salt Lake, which they still argue that isn't a main source of some of the toxics in there.
Right.
We have the drying of the lake that is now exposing a lot of these natural and industry fueled toxins. We have the dust that's coming up and getting into our air. So that's water quality, that's the industrial side, that's air quality.
Right.
And then we have this question of, okay, it's getting hotter, extreme heat is here, that has to be fueling some sort of the like rapidization of the Great Salt Lake drying. So I think those cumulative impacts and how they're all compounding is getting more severe every year. And it's something that I think we need to really, on a local and federal level, take a really big look at. Because I think there's been a lot of efforts to, okay, we're going to save the Great Salt Lake. That means we're just going to put more water into it, and kind of siloing our solutions, where we should expand throughout, look at all the different prongs that are being attacked.
And what are some of the strides that Green Latinos has made in these last couple years that you see as hopeful or you see as moving in a good direction?
Yeah, definitely. I think one of them that's really exciting is our Take Back Cinco de Mayo campaign. So we have a campaign that tries to take back that holiday. Right now it's associated with margaritas and partying and all of that.
Right.
But we're trying to bring back the holiday to kind of some of the roots, which is community coming together to stand for their community and to kind of fight back. So we're bringing those roots back, and we've been able to create a declaration where we have hundreds of organizations, both environmental, Latino, all across the board, that have signed on to this. And we've been actually pitching it to different cities to make it as an actual resolution. And we're also trying to pitch this federally. So we've been making really good strides of getting that back, the backing of the orgs and the different people. And we've had really good luck in New Mexico. I think that's our first state that this will actually become true, where we will have this resolution passed in the state. And here in Salt Lake, I know we're hoping to pitch it to Salt Lake City first and seeing if we can grow it out from there. So, and with that resolution, we also have a kind of like a community calendar that we're creating for that day. So different organizations or individuals who want to do conservation focused events can post them there and can kind of organize. And then we're hoping to get a lot of funding into those different events as well. So this is from river cleanups to environmental webinars, things like that, to kind of recenter that holiday on action and making it a little bit more conservation related. We also have our urban greening program, which I can't remember the exact number, but I think it's over 2.6 million that we've been able to redistribute into urban greening projects. This means like parks in a lot of Latino communities.
Right.
These are majority in LA, Albuquerque, and Chicago, Illinois. But we're hoping to expand this. So we know that there are a lot of areas that have been redlined, have not had this infrastructure of green infrastructure in their communities. So we're hoping to kind of correct that course with this program. So hopefully we see one on the west side of Salt Lake.
I'm glad you mentioned like parks and the concept of trees, the role that they play in neighborhoods. Because as you alluded to, you know, extreme heat is another thing that you know urban settings face in a force multiplier way, and it's not as simple as you know homeowners or renters can say, well, you know, just go out and get an air conditioner and problem solved. That's money, and so yes, it's great that you know we're learning that the import of greening urban set of streets with ideally
so
more
benefits.
Parks, but just more trees and the shade and the value that brings. So that's great that some of that funding goes to those things.
Yeah, definitely. And it kind of goes beyond, like, as you said, like, there's so many benefits to it, even like mental health.
Yes.
Like I know when I'm like in a place that's just like concrete and no shade, like it just takes a toll on you.
Yes.
Where compared to like a park, right, really helps out. So it's been really great to see that program flourish. And hoping to expand that.
That's phenomenal. I love the thought of helping green these cities and bringing everyone, like you said, the multiple benefits that a trees or a park can bring to us as humans.
Water features
and
or whatever.
Connectivity
yeah.
to, again, the land is a big deal for us,
yeah.
I think, in this day and age of our warming climate and how we're distracting ourselves or taking ourselves away from the planet and our green spaces. So I think that's really incredible. Macy, I'm curious about you as well. What brought you into this line of work? I know that you've also done some work with Heal Utah. Tell us about your background and why this is so important to you.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm a born and raised Salt Laker, so grew up, well, Salt Lake Valley, I guess I should say. I've grown up throughout the whole valley. And I grew up in a lot of these areas that were historically redlined and didn't really know this until growing, until a little bit later in my life that, oh, there are like disparities between my neighborhood and maybe a friend's neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So my parents migrated here from Mexico, and we first lived in the Rose Park area, and then later lived in West Valley City, and then Magna and Kearns. So I got to kind of experience the whole West Side, which I absolutely love. Beautiful culture, beautiful people, best food. If you guys are in the Salt Lake Valley, like that is where you find the best food.
Right.
But also, sadly, it was the area with a lot of pollution and a lot of lack of resources. So I noticed, oh, okay, I'm closer to like the landfill, and like my view of the mountains is always has that, like, I think it's the Rocky Mountain coals thing that they're trying to put the new ballpark in. So those are my views
right.
of the mountain. And later on, my parents actually started busing me to the east side for school. And that's when I really saw these disparities. So that's kind of like where a lot of this sparked, with more of trying to get more resources and trying to kind of combat a lot of these issues. And the environmental space just kept kind of speaking to me. It didn't look like me. It wasn't really a place that I felt like really invited in, but I kept seeing people making decisions for our communities without a lot of our voices. So I remember going to a West Valley City Council meeting. And if you know West Valley, it's the most diverse city of Utah, if I remember correctly. And not seeing any of our communities on that council really upset me. And what upset me even more is how empty that council meeting was, and how I think they put like forward, the most recent one that I went to, they put forward a resolution that they won't be participating in 100 renewable communities to get renewable energy, sourced energy into West Valley City. And it was just a quick, no, we're not doing this, move on. So things like that really sparked me to get interested in this. And as you mentioned, I worked with HEAL to work on local issues. And now I'm hoping to do a lot of this more on a federal area, because in Utah, a lot of our local efforts kind of get stalled. And then our federal protections were the things that kind of were our backstop. So things like NEPA, the Clean Air Act, always were our backstop to be protected. And now those things are being under attack. So I kind of felt like, okay, now I got to work on that side.
Well, in the last minute or so, are there any politicians, local or otherwise, that feel that your story is resonating with them?
You know, I'm not too sure. I know I've worked with a variety of state lawmakers. I've worked with like Escamilla, Derek Kitchen when he was a senator, been able to work with them. And they always encourage me to run. And that's something maybe we'll do in the future. But right now, I think I'm still like the environmental nerd reading all these policies.
Right. You got time.
Well, it is an organization called Green Latinos. And Maysay, can you tell us where people can go to learn more about this organization and your programs and how they might be able to get involved?
Yeah, definitely. So we invite everyone to join Green Latinos by going to greenlatinos.org. We have what is called colectivos, and these are spaces in each of those programs that were mentioned, climate justice, clean air, sustainable communities, and public lands. And there you can get the latest updates, invites to events, and learn more about our programs. So again, feel free to sign up at greenlatinos.org. And we're also on all social media platforms, if that's more your style, at Green Latinos.
Great. This is climate justice and clean air advocate Maysay Gonzalez of Green Latinos. Thank you so much for talking with us today, Maysay, on This Green Earth.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us here.
Take care, and I'm sure we'll connect again soon. Thanks, yep. Maysay.
Yeah, definitely. Have a good one.
Thanks.
Bye.
We got a couple minutes. I do want to give a little update on some of the fires going on within and around Utah. It is fire season, and I got a few here. First of all, 60% of the state is in either a severe or extreme drought category. So we're really dry. Mm-hmm. Not surprising. It's
not
summer.
Surprising.
It's the dry season in general. But it's last week it was 51%. This week it's 60. And if things continue, you know, it'll be maybe 65% next week. So we're in a drought condition. Some of the larger fires that are going on is the France Canyon Fire. That's just west of Bryce Canyon National Park. It's 35,000 acres in size, but it's 90% contained. And by that, it's pretty much, you know, it's not out, but its degree of spreading is probably decreased dramatically. So it may not grow too much from there. Deer Creek Fire, 15 miles southeast of Utah. That's the one, southeast of Moab. That's got a lot of airplay on the news. It's 17,000 acres, 55% contained. Again, that's pretty good as far as containment goes. But it's still spreading east, and it's actually spreading into Colorado.
Right, and that is the one that I saw that I alluded to earlier.
Okay.
As we were driving, and it was we knew there was something awful going on because of the plume of smoke.
That's a big one.
Monroe Canyon Fire. That's 15 miles south of Richland. It's 10,000 acres, but it's so not as big, but it's only 3% contained. So it's a fairly recent one, and it's burning, you know, effectively uncontrolled with limited control right now. So that's south of Richland. Finally, the Forsyth Fire, 15 miles north or so of St. George, 16,000 acres, but 95% contained. So these are the four biggest fires, roughly 80,000 acres total in and around the state, which is about 125 square miles. So picture an area that's 10 miles wide by 12 miles long. That's how much is burning or has burned in the state of Utah. And it continues.
And we've talked a lot about here the natural state of fires, that they do occur. They're supposed to occur. It is a natural occurrence in nature, and how our containment or our encroaching on these areas with homes is really gotten a little bit dicey.
Right. That's a good point. I don't know the source of a lot of these fires. It could be lightning. Maybe there is a man-made source, you know, here or there. I'll have to look into that, but that's a good point. To be continued, because we got to wrap up.
We're going to have someone on the show, again, speaking to this, speaking about wildfire, because it is wildfire season, and how we as humans approach this.
As humans, yes.
And how we look at it. So something to look forward to here on This Green Earth, getting more education about that. Thanks for listening to This Green Earth. If you like the show and you learned something new, make sure you leave a review, and we'd appreciate it if you click 5 stars.